But there was such a difference because the whole story of Lincoln just went out like this from his particular life. And so many things about him exemplified universal realities that we all aspire to. Insofar as the George O'Keefe book was inspiring, were the parts where it was really about artistic effort and not about her artistic effort. Do you see the difference? It was so reflecting on it. It was such an interesting example of the particular versus the universal, even just in the stories about individuals. I read a biography of Walt Disney, and it was a little bit. You know, he was more like George O'Keefe in a certain sense, but the biographer had a more expanded understanding of him, and it sort of fell somewhere between Lincoln and George O'Keefe, because there was just more this sense of Lincoln, of Disney, moving out and trying to help. You know, just really, how do you say it? You had just more of a feeling of the way creativity flowed through him. The whole story was more about the creative process and less about him compared to the other book. And I suspect that George O'Keefe's biography could have been written more expansively, but the person who did it wasn't thinking like that. Another example, and this is about spiritual stories. You know, someone will ask Swamiji, tell me some stories about Master. And Swami always says, he can't. If you ask him that, his mind goes blank. He said he can't just remember stories. He can only remember stories about Master in the context of trying to illustrate some spiritual principle. And then they'll come flooding into his mind, because that's simply how he understands Masters in terms of the spiritual principles that his life illustrated. And he doesn't tell certain stories because they're facts, but they don't necessarily enhance that. And he's taught us all to be like that, and he's trained us instinctively like that. I was at Satsang this was like many years ago, almost 20, when Muktananda had just passed away, and Chidvilasananda, Guru Mai they call her now, had just taken over his work, and David and I were on a lecture tour, and we were in Santa Monica, and we had a night off, and as it happened, she was giving a satsang, and we'd never seen her, so we went. It was this huge 700 people in this gigantic room. It was this huge show. And whenever I visited any other spiritual teacher in my life, I'm always so grateful that I'm on this path and not any other path. Now, nothing to do with their quality. I'm just, you know, this one fits. But in any case, it was like 3 hours, and she didn't come in until well after an hour. And many things happened before, including a number of her devotees standing up and speaking. And her devotees were essentially our counterparts. People who had had a comparable experience to the experience we've had. Nice people, articulate people, clever, funny. 3 or 4 people spoke. They told very interesting stories. But I observed that not one of them made any effort to universalize what they were saying. They would just talk about, I was here and she did that. And one woman told this incredibly, extremely interesting, fascinating combination of events of, you know, things happening on several continents over different years. And I mean, it was all meant to make you be very interested in meeting the woman who was about to come out and to be predisposed to think that she had something unusual that you would want. And it was a fair thing to have done. But you ended up, after all of those speeches, thinking how lucky they were, you know? And also, to a certain extent, thinking, how will I ever get anywhere? Because I'll never have those experiences. Because they had just never been told to use their creative energy to universalize the experience. I mean, they could have. It would have been very easy to have told all those stories exactly as they told them and then just gone the next step, to be expansive with their creativity instead of using it to draw it to one focus that nobody else could relate to. You see? And it just depends on how you're oriented. It's how you're oriented toward life in general. And these are qualities that you can't just sort of develop as soon as you pick up your paintbrush. And this is where earlier Swamiji is remarking, you know, you have to work on yourself. The masterpiece you have to work on above all is yourself. Which way does your consciousness go with your experiences, all your experiences in life? Are you always looking for the universal, or is everything about your life coming back to you? I mean, you can see when the way people look, the way people behave, it's just the way we are, the way we are ourselves. Things just tend to circle back. And you either make a tremendous effort to keep your energy always in an expansive direction, and then your creative energy will naturally go that way. And just those wonderful examples that he gives from the Rig Veda, you know, first of all dawns, last of all dawns that have come before, first of all dawns that are yet to come. Isn't that just exquisite? And there it is. It's just the dawn. But the individual looking at it, having this expanded vision, sees it in this great flow of time and space, picking up the grain of sand on the beach. And it's just a grain of sand, but one sees it suddenly in this enormous context. And so if one has even a very small or even an intensely difficult experience that you then want to translate into a painting or a dance or a song or a poem or whatever it might be that you want to do, do you look to see how that experience can be universalized, or do you thrash around in ever more contractive circles about things that only relate to you? And of course, much art is just like that, and it just lives and dies. It gets thrown out after a while because nobody can use it. And art that's really great, it's not necessarily even recognized at first, but gradually it just insinuates itself more and more into the universal consciousness until you can't live without it. And it just becomes a classic for all time. It's very interesting, isn't it? Any comments or questions or thoughts? My marking these books is so absurd because I virtually marked the whole chapter. I finally realized it's just my way of like impressing it on my own mind. If I make it yellow, you know, then I'll remember it. I don't want to really look at the book. Then Swami talks about self-realization through art. I mean, it's sort of like, this is like the heart of the book. And he gives it, he takes it from two sides. He takes it from art appreciation as a pathway to self-realization, which was actually sort of interesting, you know, learning to tune in and the role that art can play, because he goes back to this theme which he started, which is that thoughts begin to differentiate themselves from the mass, from the infinite, first by feeling and only secondarily by intellect. And it's sometimes because this path doesn't concern itself so much with emotions, sometimes people miss the extent to which feeling is the fundamental reality. And so it was very interesting through this book for Swami to just say that over and over again, you know, that how much heart is completely involved in being on the spiritual path. I remember when I was first getting to know Swamiji, because I enjoy intellectual things. I enjoy verbal conversation and I enjoy thinking. And I tend to come first from my mind. I just so enjoyed that about Swamiji. And, you know, even now I'm just so grateful that he has that personality. I mean, it doesn't have to have had that personality, but it works for me, and I'm glad. This is just entirely personal. And I think it works for a lot of us, and we're all glad. You know, here we are studying this book because he wrote it. He didn't have to write any books, but he did. But I was so fascinated by the extraordinary nature of his thoughts, you know, how he could look at situations and just understand them. I mean, I was a young girl in my 20s and not a very experienced I didn't have any basis for any of my ideas. And I was just so impressed. And I was just so impressed by how he could, well, clarity, actually. I was just so impressed by his clarity. And I used to wonder, how can he be so clear? And then one day I noticed his posture is less exaggerated now. He's an older man and his body has caved in a little bit. But then he was so, and he was bigger. And then I just looked at the plane of his, the way he approached life, and he, the plane of air was cut first by his heart and second by his head. Do you know? Because his posture has always been very exaggerated like that. And so it's like the push. I mean, I don't know if it was literally true, but the push of his energy was always heart first. And I observed myself that the push of my energy was I push on the world with my head. You know, and you'll see people, a lot of people do, who are intellectually inclined, will push on the world with their head. And he pushes on the world first with his heart. And I became very aware that the clarity of his mind was because of the clarity of his heart. And clarity of the heart meaning that there was no fear. There was no fear in his heart to see what reality was. And so therefore he could see it very clearly. He just didn't have anything to protect. So much of us have so much to protect. Somebody, for example, come to us, let's just say with a good idea for something. But the implications of that idea are going to be a lot of work for us, for example. And so immediately we'll say it's not a good idea. And we'll never have actually heard whether it was a good idea. We'll just subconsciously know that it's going to be too much work for us, so we have to destroy that as a good idea, right? Or somebody will come to us with news about someone else that if we accept that as true, it will, again, have all sorts of implications for us that we may not want to face. Maybe that person will be unsuitable for the job they're doing, and you're going to have to find somebody else for the job, and that's going to be a lot of work. And so you answer them by saying, no, that didn't really happen. I mean, just watch ourselves. We do it all the time. Reason follows feeling. But if feeling is clear, then reason is clear. And we have to be very, very careful when we instinctively respond to things where that's coming from. Now, Swami goes a step, I mean, so I've always sort of had that thought, but Swami goes farther in this by saying that before what causes thoughts to arise is feeling first. It was a very interesting statement. And so art is one of the best ways to refine our feelings. Because if we can refine our feelings, we will then refine our thoughts. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's just, I remember when I read this book the first time, the enormous importance of art took me a little by surprise. Because I just wasn't thinking about it, even though, you know, I'm involved in being a creative person. I have been my whole life, but I always saw it as peripheral. Swami puts it right in the center. It's like the appreciation and the understanding and the creation of art is a guide to self-realization. Because we can not only, and this is where in these chapters he not only talks about throwing ourselves into it and creating, but also learning to receive the vibrations, the elevated vibrations, and to appreciate those elevated vibrations as they come through artistic works will also then gradually refine our feelings. Well, I mean, think of a very simple thing. Surrounding yourself with beauty, thinking about the kind of music you listen to. I mean, just those two things right there. You know, that if you're in an environment in which the refined consciousness is constantly being reinforced, then you will become more refined in your own nature. If you are surrounding yourself with environments in which unrefined vibrations are constantly coming into you, then you will begin to become like those. And the more unrefined our feelings, the more unrefined our thoughts. I mean, it makes living in this world kind of tricky, so you don't want to get real paranoid about it. But it also speaks very strongly for the importance of doing things in the right way. And this is Swami's life, Master's life. And, you know, Master created beauty. He went through a great deal of effort. He bought Lake Shrine, or it was given to him, and he worked very hard to make it beautiful. He didn't just sort of let it be. And Swamiji has been very, people have been irritated because he doesn't, well, we were here and we drove by Shoreline, and I said, well, it's Shoreline Park. He said, that's not a park, that's a swamp. You know? And I always call it swamp ever since then, but it's like, but sir, it's a natural habitat. He said, it's a swamp. And yes, it's a natural habitat, and you can go down there and you can see all the animals in their natural habitat, and I do. But it's a swamp. It's just mud. There's nothing, no human consciousness has raised the vibration of it as it can. Now, of course, you work with nature, you don't work against it and so on, but at Ananda Village, he's always been in favor of clearing it out and making it park-like. And then there's been, you know, a strong voice that says we should leave it the way it was. But he doesn't, he looks at it, it's chaos. You know, it's not beautiful, it's not refined, it's just there. And in his own home, everywhere. Do you see what I'm trying to say? It's very interesting to contemplate it. And so then he gives us all these different, ideas about, he goes into the chakras and different levels of vibrations from which they come, which is all things that you all are familiar with, so I won't go into it here. But that's the main point. If you create art or surround yourself with things that are reminiscent or emanate from the lower chakras, that's where you end up. You know, and he says, you know, bodies that are squat and all the energy goes down. I look at Cindy and I know when Swami talks about dance, he talks about it, you know, with an upward movement, moving from the upper part of the body and uplifting the energy in this way and not, you know, the real heavy, hard, that kind of thing. Although Indian dance, you know, has that, they wear the bells on their legs and they use their feet a great deal, but somehow the net result of that is not downward pulling. So it's not as simple as, of course, you have to dance with your feet. What else would you dance with? You're standing there, you just sort of wave your arms around. So it's not like your feet are not part of the story, but it all has to do with where your consciousness is going while you're doing it. It's extremely interesting. Well, let's take a short break. Do we have the tape in the back on pause, or are we recording? No, okay. All right. Anything anyone wants to say? And the next two chapters, we've sort of been kind of going all over the map with this one, but it's really fun. And Swamiji talks about, you know, being an artist and how meditation plays into art, and talks about how all great artists, whether they know it or not, must do something like meditation. This is what where we started. That there has to be some point of stillness in which you receive inspiration if what you're doing is reflective of all, at all of higher consciousness. I remember I had a very odd experience once of meeting a woman. She was either a realtor or a banker. And, I mean, I know everyone has an immortal soul and is a child of God. But she appeared to have no center. I've never been with a person who was so just restless and just so, she just appeared to have no center. I mean, it was so exhausting to be in her company. I mean, I've been with many restless people, but this one, like, she was just way beyond. She just seemed to have no point of rest in anything that she did. I just thought it must be so exhausting to be her. And so oftentimes, Even very creative, artistic people are just like that. They're just always pushing and pushing. And those are the kind of creative people who go crazy because there's no inner reality from which they move. So he's, again, telling us, if you really want to use art for self-realization, it has to come out of some attempt to attune yourself to your higher self. So he gives basic instructions for meditation. And then he sort of throws in somewhere in there that the key to it all is love.